Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, this is Maggie Vo. I'm the Managing General Partners and Chief Investment Officer of Fuel Venture Capital. Fuel Venture Capital is a venture capital fund based in Coconut Grove in Miami. We invest in mid-stage from early to late-stage technology companies. And I'm very happy to be here on Ivy Podcast to have a conversation and share my experience.
That's great, Maggie. Thanks so much for making time joining us on the Ivy Podcast. Before we talk about Fuel Capital and everything you're currently doing, give us a thumbnail version of your career to date.
So my career, I started my career in fund management business. I always know that I love to be in investment and in fund management business. So when I started, I make a goal that I want to work for different funds so that I can learn about different asset class. So because of that, I has moved from, public market fund and then real estate fund. And right before joining Fuel Venture Capital, I was a hedge fund manager managing a global long short equity strategy. And the main reason I'm doing that is, being in America, I understand that every investor, they build a diversified portfolio. And the best way for me to advise them in terms of investment strategy, I need to understand different asset classes. And then about 3 years ago, I made the move from the public market to join the private market. The main reason is when I work with my clients, they're pushing me to go into the private market so that I can find the access to the unique opportunity for them, especially at the early stage, because they notice that a lot of technology companies these days, they no longer join the public market like Amazon back in 1990 something, when it was only like 3 years old and the valuation is only, $300 million valuation. Nowadays, you have company like Facebook, Uber, who decide to join the public market when they were already 10 years old and valuation is billion valuation. So a lot of my investors, they realize that most of the value creation is in the private market. So they want me to join the private market to help them to get access to those investment opportunities. And that's explain why I'm here today at Fuel Venture Capital and doing what I'm supposed to do.
Well, that's super exciting, very diverse background, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. So in terms of your current role as a chief investment officer and as a partner within the venture capital firm, give us an overview of what your average day looks like. What falls under your purview, what falls under your area of responsibility. And more importantly, out of the majority of time that you spend on, how much of that do you actually want to spend on?
One thing I think very kind of like fascinated me about the role I'm doing right now is, every day is different. You don't have the same day. So it's really hard for me to tell you like what is the average day look like. But I normally will come in, and want to check, my email, following up with, email from investor and founders. And then I will sit there with my investment team as a chief investment officer. I want to make sure that I understand what my analyst and my associate is working on. And that is how I roll my days. And it's depend, right? I mean, we headquarter in Coconut Grove, Miami. And as the economy start opening, we have a lot of visitors. We have investors from all over the place, from Latin America, from Europe and Israel. So I will get some visit from my investor who want to have a review on the portfolio, understand about what the portfolio companies are doing and see how they can help them. So that will be majority in the morning. I try to set up, meeting in the morning. And then during lunchtime, trying to take advantage of the tech movement in Miami right now, as you can see that a lot of people moving down here from founder perspective to like a lot of VC moving down here. I try to build my syndicate group. So over lunchtime, I normally will spend some time with all the VC team just to kind of like get to know each other and building the network. And coming back from lunch, normally I try to spend, you know, in the afternoon with founders, either sitting on the board meeting, you know, for the companies that I'm on the board, or working on certain project with, you know, a portfolio companies that trying to, you know, do certain thing like improve certain metrics or build financial models or talking about a new fundraising. So I spend the afternoon with the founders, and, you know, closer to about 3 to later in the afternoon, I will go back and spend, you know, time with my team internal meeting, making sure that we review our deal flows or, you know, working on investment memo on any companies that, you know, we normally, we currently work performing the due diligence on. So that's how the day look.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I agree with you with angel investing and venture capital, it's never the same day every day. It's a lot of moving parts. So it can definitely relate to what you're dealing with just in general. So with those that are not so intimately familiar with the different roles in venture capital, I realize the structure of every venture firm is different to a certain extent. As a chief investment officer, tell us a little bit more about what actually falls under your area of responsibility as, you know, as a functional role versus the investor or the general partner or, you know, the associates that you have, or, you know, even as a chief financial officer. Just give us a little bit of a, you know, overview from that perspective.
So my background is in math and finance, and I also have my CFA designation, which is, you know, the most respected designation in the financial industry. And obviously, when I share with you that I have a background in math, finance, and CFA, you know that majority of my responsibility is in investment, in number oriented. Basically my main responsibility at, you know, beginning when we start the fund is to identify investment opportunity and performing due diligence on, you know, the opportunities. The way it's breakdown, you know, in the fund is we have the analysts and the associate to screen and scrub deals, means that we have a couple checkpoint for them to go through, because as you know, performing due diligence take a lot of time, and I don't want, you know, me spending so much time performing expensive research and, you know, analysis, and then you decide that, you know, unless there's some real red flag, you decide that you don't want to invest. So that's waste a lot of time. So at my team, the way it works is I have my analyst team to do what we call a first pass analysis. It's a preliminary due diligence, making sure that, you know, on the box is checked, like the market is growing or not, or how's the team looking, how's the business model, etc. And then if the company pass first pass analysis, that's when they push it into my team, which is I'm responsible mainly for doing the deep dive due diligence. The way I always describe is for the analyst to accumulate information. That's basically the stage that whatever the founders say to you, you take it for a fact and assume that they're saying the right thing. And then when it's come to me, I'm basically doing the validating the fact. So a lot of time people will tell you that they're in $1 billion market size. And then after due diligence, you figure out that, oh no, you're actually in a niche market. Or when they give you the financial model, they will build with their bias. They're optimistic that, you know, this is a great business model, a great market. And then I have to like redone all of the models. And, you know, and moving from that, I will look at the deal term, try to understand the valuation, perform the valuation analysis. Because, you know, at Fuel, we believe that the thing affecting, you know, the return for our investor is two things. One is the valuation numbers and the term. So I'm responsible for that fact too.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And definitely seems like there's a, you know, specific structure to this in terms of the actual area of responsibility. So that's pretty exciting. So moving on a little bit, you talked about evaluating founders, which, you know, we know it's one of the critical components of every formula as you evaluate every company you decide to invest in. Tell us a little bit more about your thesis, or just in general, your approach to looking at the early indicators when you evaluate the founders, you know, starting from the very first meeting to how you progress. Give us a little bit more of a, you know, insider look. How does that process look like? What do you look for? Would love to get your thoughts from that perspective.
Thank you. That's a great question. So the way I look at founders, normally we will meet founder after, you know, the company passed the first pass analysis, because I want to know, you know, to interact with founders. I normally really like to meet them in person. And I look at, you know, the founder analysis from three different aspects. The first one is I try to determine if the founders have any unfair competitive advantage. And when I say unfair competitive advantage, means that they need to prove it to me why they're the person building this specific company instead of, you know, the next person that I'm meeting with. And that unfair competitive advantage normally being demonstrated by maybe, you know, their background, their working experience, or maybe their, you know, what they're studying at school. And what I want to figure out is this passion is not just one day they wake up and they come up with a nice idea and let's try to build a company. I want is a long-term passion that, you know, they have been nurtured, they have been educated themselves. And because of that, they have some unfair competitive advantage, like, you know, the insight about the problem, the insight about the solution to solve the problem. On the other hand, they have, you know, the network, because as you know, one of the problems for company is to get the first customer. And if they have the network in that verticals, because of their background, that will be easier for the company to approach the first customer. So that's, you know, the first thing I look at. For example, my tax file portfolio companies, the founder is the CPA working for PricewaterhouseCoopers. So it's very easy and understandable that, you know, he wants to build a startup company in the tax accounting industry. So that's the number one. And the number two is all about, you know, the want factor, which is more like the attitude, the resilient, how passionate you are, you know, and how energetic you are about the problem. Because as you know, right, I mean, life in startup is not just like a one straight line going up, it's going down and it's going sideways. So I think that the main thing to keep the founder, keep bounce back from failure, is they have to have the passion, they have to have the energy. And obviously the last one, the last aspect, the most important thing is they need to be able to show me the ability to execute. Like for example, one thing, I want to see the founder have ability to sell. Why I'm saying that? Because first, if he believe in something and if he doesn't know how to articulate to sell his belief, it's already a failure, because he needs to attract more people to join his team. He needs to attract an investor to join his cap table. That's before even, you know, trying to convince customer to buy the product. So I really want to see that he's had the ability to execute, to sell the product and to build a product.
So, and thank you for that. The ability to execute, I agree, is extremely important. Also, take that a little bit further, ability to recruit, because at the end of the day, even if you have a co-founder or a couple of co-founders, you're going to need to convince, recruit, and hire some, you know, exceptional engineers, exceptional salespeople, whatever the case may be. Surround yourself, surround your startup with, you know, the top performers. So for the founders, especially first-time founders, they oftentimes, I notice, overlook that very important component, the ability to recruit and really build a team that, you know, as you grow and scale. What are some of the recommendations you have when you work with your portfolio companies when it comes to staffing, recruiting, and overall talent acquisition? Because as a startup, you don't have a brand name, you don't have that much of attraction, you don't have a lot to offer except for some compensation of the package for the particular employee equity included. What other recommendations that you provide to your founders when it comes to effective hiring strategies?
Yeah, I think, you know, people have tendency to like people who are similar to them. Or even when you try to find the founders, you normally want to hit up your college roommate, because, you know, they probably study the same major, understand about the same thing. But I do think, I look at things a little bit opposite. I want to find the founders, or I want to find the people joining the team are totally opposite to me. So for example, at Fuel Venture Capital, we manage the fund. I have the founding partner who is Jeff Ransdell, and he and I work so well together because we complement to each other and because we opposite, right? So let's say that I'm more number crunching and go deep dive into bottom up. he will be more like a top-down person. He will be very good at upfront talking to investor, fundraising, and sharing the top, you know, the big picture, the vision. So when investors come to us, they look at us kind of like the two balance each other. You listen to the story first, and then you look at the number to make sure that it's verified the story. So the same with the, you know, founders, they need to find someone who can complement them, who totally different from them. If you like, if you are tech founders, you don't want to find another tech founders, because when I look at the companies, the founding team, I want to see the dynamic. I want to see someone so good at selling, like fundraising, or someone will be, you know, very good at the technology to build a product. So don't, you know, hesitate to hire someone totally different from you. And normally they will be the one that who can remove a lot of stress from your life.
No, those are great recommendations. They can definitely relate on many levels. As a fund, do you guys, are you industry agnostic, or do you have particular specialization that you guys like to focus when you evaluate certain companies for investments?
So, you know, we have our first flagship fund, and the way we look at things is because I'm coming from the background of, you know, hedge fund risk management, so I'm very focused on portfolio allocation. So for the flagship fund, we go wide instead of going deep. And going wide have the benefit is diversification. So right now for the flagship fund, we have, you know, 8 different focus. We have big position in fintech. We have big data. We have IoT, robotic, and AI. So basically, we want to invest in one of the transformative technology. And the reason we go wide instead of going deep is, you know, at the beginning, when you invest in startup, the one thing different from public investing and private investing is the amount of knowledge that you have. You can try to do a lot of due diligence, but keep in mind that startup will pivot, will changing. So you want to invest and then accumulate more information, build relationship with founders. So that's why we go in wide, so that the diversification protecting us, non-companies can just bring it us now. But then further, as we grow fuel venture capital, the second fund right now we're raising is more sector focus. We have a fintech focus. And the main reason we're doing that is we move from the flagship with 25 companies. Now we go into the fintech focus with only 5 companies. And the way I explain to my investor is the knowledge risk now is, you know, reduced, because most of the company in the fintech sector focus is from our flagship. And we have been build relationship with the founders. We understand the business. Now they go into the stage that they need growth capital. And obviously they are the winner. So you want to keep funding the capital. But because the knowledge risk is going down, it's allowed you to take different risks. So we take concentration risk. So in the fintech sector focus, we only have 5 companies, but we double down on the 5 that we believe that this will be successful.
Right. No, that's very interesting. And, you know, I've been studying that a lot. The whether to select a niche and specialize as a thesis from investment perspective, or keep, you know, more of a generalist approach, because there's always the, you know, that balancing act. There's all the advantages and disadvantages, but I love your perspective on that. So that's very interesting. So when you evaluate, I'm pretty sure you study different trends, industries, ideas on a daily basis. What ideas that really excite you these days? What are the different trends that you're very passionate about, that you kind of, you know, you're very, very bullish on, in terms of whether that's your particular area of investment or just in general?
Right now, as I mentioned earlier, the reason that we raised the second fund and focus on fintech is should sending you some signal that I'm very interested in fintech. In the second fund, the way we do things is, you know, we try to benefit from that trend all over the world, not just in the US, because, for example, in some developed countries like, you know, US and UK, we invest in you know, B2C fintech companies and B2B. In the Nordic region, last week we just entered a challenger bank with a monopolistic characteristic. So that is, you know, we build a position in the Nordic region. And then in Latin America, or in general emerging market, actually from, you know, Vietnam, where I'm coming from, now there's a trend that, you know, in emerging market, they move from cash and they go straight to the mobile payment. They skip the whole credit card, you know, stage, which is very interesting. And you know, most of the emerging market, they benefit from the new technology and they adopt it very fast. So I just love the fact that when I invested in fintech, the vertical is very broad. You can go from insurtech, you can go from real estate tech. And with the growth of the fintech since 2000, I would say 2008, after the financial crisis, nowadays you have so many fintech companies and they really focus on, you know, building the infrastructure and provide the vertical as like infrastructure as a service, which allow the other fintech company to grow faster. So nowadays, you look at any companies, they can turn themselves into a fintech. Doesn't matter if they are marketplace, doesn't matter if they are e-commerce. They will figure out somehow to sell and generate revenue from the fintech perspective, and which I find is a very optimistic trend.
Right. No, that's very interesting. I can definitely agree with you from the fintech perspective. There's a lot of opportunity and a lot of, on scratch surface when it comes to solutions that could be developed to improve that overall industry. One thing that I want to also point out is something that I've been very passionate about when it comes to investment thesis is not really a trend, but part of a formula that I love to subscribe to is investment into immigrants and surrounding, you know, the kind of my investment syndicate with fellow immigrants, those that have, you know, come from, you know, other parts of the world here to US, had certain success and now looking, you know, for ways to pay forward. And, you know, it's definitely not a knock on anything for those that are born here, but it's just I'm able to connect on more levels with other immigrants from a perspective of just being very scrappy and in a sense, finding creative ways to succeed with limited resources. So I think that resonates a lot with some of the founders that, you know, I'm backing. So that's very interesting from just the overall, as we talk about trends.
I'm so glad that you mentioned it because I'm an immigrant too. And I think there's so many things to talk about immigrant, you know, coming to the US and try to provide a disruptive solution. And with their very strong, you know, work ethics and going back to piggyback on what you just say, right? Immigrant coming here with nothing. So they really know how to learn how to do less, with less but doing more things. And I think that is a very important characteristic to have in startup because that at the point you have very limited resource, not just from capital standpoint, but from the human power too. So you really need to know how to capitalize, you know, the resource that you have.
Right. No, I love that. We could probably talk the rest of the podcast about this particular topic, but quite a few other areas I want to cover with you, which are very interesting to me from a standpoint of a value add investor, because we hear that a lot. I've been, you know, on both sides as a founder operator, as an investor, and there's different perspectives when it comes to, you know, one side providing the value, the other side seeking value. But at the same time, just the overall premise that I love to subscribe to is as a founder operator, the ball is in your court to derive the value that you want to derive from the investor and not necessarily for an investor to make that first step. So just curious to get your thoughts on the overall concept of a value at investor. How do you approach this and actually how do you provide value to your founders that you back aside from the financial support and capital investment?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for that. You know, at the beginning, when we start the partnership with any founders, we only emphasize that we are an active investor. We're not passive investor. It means that we're not just giving you the money and then let you do whatever you want and then come back later and ask for more. So we're pretty involved. And that's the reason I would love for you to come to our headquarters. The way we build here is we don't want just to be a venture capital fund. We build an ecosystem here from idea to exit. We realize that, you know, company go through different stages. They need different help. And, you know, that's why as the name is Fuel Venture Capital, we built, surrounded us with different fuel station. So we have a talent station. We have, you know, a team to help, you know, our portfolio companies when they're scaling and need to hire new people, they can work with our talent station. And as you already work with our PR station, sales and marketing, I think that is one of our strongest fuel station because a lot of our company is in, you know, the Series A, Series B when they start scaling. You want to make sure that the name of the company is out there to gain, you know, to have like brand brand enhancement or to get, you know, well-known and trusted. So a lot of our portfolio companies actually working with our, you know, PR, our marketing station. And, you know, if you follow us on Instagram, you see that they're on the news, either Wall Street or TechCrunch Business Insider. So that's one station. We have the tech station, technology station. I'm the finance person. My partners is finance too. So we work with different tech team all over the world in, you know, Asia, Latin America, making sure that if the portfolio company needs some support, we can provide to them. And then go from there, you kind of like seeing what we're trying to build around here is an ecosystem. And recently we add something called a SPAC station. Given the trend in the SPAC market, we think that it's very smart for us to keep an eye on the trend. And we have, you know, a good pipeline organic of portfolio companies, which, you know, doing so well. So we want to make sure that we understand the SPAC very well, because that is a way for those companies to exit. So we add the SPAC station to our ecosystem also.
I love that. I love the whole concept of stations and being able to select and laser focus on certain areas where the founders really need help and bring that expertise. And, you know, just at the end of the day, provide those resources, which, you know, that's exceptional. I think a lot of venture capital firms should, you know, follow very, you know, somewhat of a similar structure. So that's very interesting. When, you know, from your personal standpoint, what are the different sources that you utilize on a daily basis as part of your content diet? What do you consume for learning to stay in ahead of the curve? Share with us the sources that you consume on a daily basis.
I think that, you know, with the technology nowadays, it's democratized everything. People can find information, you know, everywhere. So it's not about, you know, a secret sauce that I have, you know, and you don't have, but it's more like how you read it and bring it together and apply it and turn it into your knowledge. But then obviously, you know, I read PitchBook and CB Insight a lot, and McKinsey too, because I want to stay on top of the industry trend. And they normally have a lot of like good piece, just focus on one technology in general and keeping me informed, you know, the fundraising, the capital that particular sector attracting from VC. From the news standpoint, I'm sure that everybody reading TechCrunch and Crunchbase just to keep an eye on, you know, what's going on in the VC. And then I subscribe to, you know, blog of one of the well-known venture capitalists, just like, for example, Anderson Horowitz, Sequoia, First Round Review, Bessemer Venture Partners, just to kind of like, you know, I like to learn from different aspects, how people view things. And then the way I always describe is you digest on the information, you bring it back, you put your style on it, and then you try to put a creative hat on it to benefit you.
Right. No, I love that. So those, you know, with so much information being thrown at us from all different angles, I love discussing the strategies, how to be very selective when it comes to exposing your mind and creating your own little bubbles. So that's, you know, not only from the learning perspective, but just in general, I think that's very interesting. So I can't help but ask also your thoughts on, and by no means don't take this as a investment advice or anything from that perspective, on the overall trend of cryptocurrency, especially, you know, lately, all of the waves that it's been riding, and with the big Miami Bitcoin conference that just happened. Just share with us your thoughts in general. What are you seeing there? Anything interesting that you've been researching?
So, you know, in terms of crypto world, I'm going to be, you know, very honest. I think that I'm more on the conservative side. The main reason, because I came from the public market, as I mentioned with you, and in the public market, the way I invest is I only invest in things I know the drivers. So I always tell people that, okay, if you invest in the US dollar, probably because you believe that the US economy is doing well, or if you invest in Apple stock because you believe that they're going to launch some products or, you know, improve their earnings, or even startup, right? I invest because I believe that the startup come up with a disruptive solution to solve certain problem. The problem I have right now, making me a little bit hesitate to go into cryptocurrency from the investing standpoint, is I don't know what is the drivers. Let's just say one day I wake up and somebody's saying something and bringing the whole market down, and I feel a little bit you know, crazy to be at the mercy of the people saying that. But on the other hand, I really have a strong interest in the blockchain, which is the technology, you know, behind the cryptocurrency. I think that blockchain provides the ability for us to record information in a way that is make it very difficult to change or to hack or to cheat the system. And I can see so many use cases using blockchain from like banking, stock trading, you know, real estate, land title, etc. And in fact, right now, I am performing a due diligence on a company using blockchain to democratize the trading, the investment in the private market.
Oh, that's interesting. And, you know, I can definitely respect the fact from just the firm conservative side, because it's something that's completely new. It's very disruptive. And it's going to be interesting how things play out in the next period or so. Maggie, last but not least, what are you currently reading in terms of a book? And is there a book that you always recommend to others? And why is that? The reason I ask this is because I just one of my personal kind of, I don't want to say hobbies, but I always gift books to a lot of my friends. That's something that I've enjoyed. And it's just, I always love to, you know, have a conversation around that.
There's one book we use a lot at Fuel Venture Capital. And we read it, and it's give us a good perspective. It's called Exponential Organization by Salim Ismail. I don't know if you know that book, but the reason that I like the book is give me, you know, a lot of refreshing ideas. And one of the thing is, you know, we invest in technology companies that know how to leverage the transformative technology to help the company scale. And in the book, they point out, you know, certain factors that can help the company scale quickly. Like, for example, leveraged asset or staff on demand. Let's talk about leveraged asset for a second. If you compare, you know, Airbnb and Hilton for it to grow to like, you know, crazy valuation like today, it takes many, many years because they have to raise capital, they have to hire people, they have to build hotel. But with Airbnb, what do you have to do? You have a house, I'm going to sign you up on my, you know, platform, and that's how I generate revenue. So if you draw it on the chart, you have the revenue grow exponentially, but you have your cost, the marginal cost is growing linearly. And that's how, you know, because we venture capitalists, we invest in company growing exponentially, and growing exponentially, the business model has to make sense from the beginning. And that's the only way for you to grow exponentially is to keep the cost low, but to, you know, generate more revenue. So that's one of the concepts that they discuss in the book, and I really like it.
Oh, wow, I love that. I'm going to add that to a growing list of book recommendations that I have. In fact, I should probably start a book club here on the Ivy Podcast. But for our listeners, we'll make the title available in the episode show notes. Maggie, I can't thank you enough for your time today. It was a short but very insightful conversation. I personally learned quite a bit. We're going to stay in touch. What I love doing with a lot of my guests is do another follow-up episode in about a year, just to see how much have changed, how much have transpired. We're going to revisit the conversation from a year ago and see what actually we were able to predict, you know, accurately.
Well, I would be sad if we only talk once a year. So I hope that the next time I will see you at the headquarters. And, you know, there's so much things, you know, moving part right now in Miami with people in town, and people want to, you know, grow the tech ecosystem, the tech community down here. So I would love for us to explore some kind of like opportunities to work together.
Absolutely. We definitely would love to. I'm going to make that happen. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.